Amen. As you notice, we are here looking at the book of Exodus, and our plan is over the next few weeks is to look at some of the highlights in the life of Moses, the great servant of God, Moses. And as we do, it's important that we kind of get acquainted with the context of this section of Exodus chapter 1, which Julio just read a portion. To understand the story, as all stories in the Bible, we have to go back to the garden. We have to go back to a time where God made man and woman to commune with him in this amazing place. And the garden was a temple. It was the meeting place between God and man. God lived with his people. God dwelled with his people. And in fact, that's always been God's plan, that he'll live with his people. And that's our picture of heaven. That's what we're headed toward. A new promised land in which we will live with him. But his original plan was that these people, this couple that he had made, would follow him, would walk with him, would spread out, would multiply over the face of the earth, that they would bring the glory of God throughout the world. That was the vision. But Satan came into the garden, the serpent of old. He tempted Adam and Eve. They turned their backs on God. And just as he had declared on war with God, they declared war with God as well. But God was gracious. He made provision for them. He provided a sacrifice and he slew an animal and covered their shame with the skins of this animal and promised that there would be another redeemer to come. And so we read about that redeemer in Genesis 3:15. It was a statement that God made to the serpent. He said, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. And so the story of the Bible takes off from there. And as we've mentioned many times, Eve had a son named Seth, and that son was the seed of the woman that would eventually make its way to the Messiah who would be born, who would rescue the world from sin. And we trace the line of Seth all the way to Noah. And then the flood of God's judgment comes upon the world and God provides an ark. And of course, the true ark that provides us salvation from the flood of God's wrath is Jesus and his cross. And then the Bible story continues on from Noah's son Shem to Abraham. And then Abraham had a family and God made a covenant with Abraham. And he said to Abraham, those who bless you will be blessed, and those who curse you will be cursed, and I will make you into a great people. He told Abraham that his descendants will be more numerous than the sands on the seashore, more numerous than the stars in the sky. And that, of course, was amazing given the fact that Abraham didn't have any children. But then God provided a son, and that son had sons, and there was a certain son named Jacob, and Jacob had 12 sons, and one of those sons ended up in Egypt. His brother sold him into slavery in Egypt, and through this remarkable story, he ends up becoming second in charge over the whole nation of Egypt, and he brings blessing to the Egyptians. He saves them from famine and starvation, and so Pharaoh blesses him and brings the family of Joseph down to Egypt and gives them the best of land so that they can graze their animals because they were shepherding people. And in some ways, this must have felt like to them that they were now in the promised land. But that wasn't the promised land. That wasn't the promised land at all. And so in the story, we notice how they discover truly that it wasn't the promised land, because we read in verse 8, it says, now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And so if you are an Egyptologist and you study the history of Egypt and maybe know a little bit about the nation, somewhere between 1650 and 1550 B.C., there was a group of people who invaded Egypt. They were called the Hyksos. They were likely Semitic people. And they took over the nation. And finally, after their reign, the Egyptians were able to push them back out. But from then on, the Egyptian people were really didn't like foreigners very much. And it had much to do with this time in history. And so now we notice that there's this king who comes along. He didn't know Joseph. It isn't that he didn't have any records about Joseph. Probably there were records of Joseph. There's probably an understanding in the Egyptian mind that something miraculous happened during Joseph's time. But the idea is that he didn't care about the contribution of Joseph, and he certainly didn't care about the contribution of Joseph's God. He didn't know him in that sense. And so we read in verses 9 and 10, because of the paranoia that began to engulf Pharaoh, one of the reasons why is because God is fulfilling his covenant promises to Abraham. One of those promises was your descendants are going to be numerous. It was a sign of God's blessing. That's what happened to them in the land. But we notice that Pharaoh then said this. He said to his people, behold, the people of Israel, by the way, this is the first time Israel's called a people. This is fulfillment of the promise that God made to Abraham, that his family would become a people. Now they have become a people. Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly. That word there for shrewdly is wisely. He means deal prudently. He means use the world's wisdom to deal with them. Let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. That word there for escape is also an interesting word. It can mean to escape, but generally it means to overwhelm, overcome. I think that there's a strong possibility that what Pharaoh was worried about is that as the nation was growing so rapidly within the land, there was fear that they would overtake the Egyptians, the Egyptian culture, and they were afraid of it. And this should not be a surprise to us, because very often when God blesses his people, the world takes that as a threat. And so they react in a way that can be dangerous. This is particularly what happened to them. Like so many tyrants, Pharaoh miscalculated the heart of God's people. What is it that we want as God's people? Anyways, we want to be salt and light in the culture, right? We want to be those who protect the culture from rotting. In fact, when the children of Israel ended up in exile in Babylon, they wondered how they were supposed to live. And we notice here that there's a clear statement of the God's will for them. And it's God's will for us in our day. And it's found in Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 7. It says this, but seek the welfare of the city where I sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. So as believers interacting with people within the culture, with others, our goal is to be a blessing to the people around us. But that's not how Pharaoh took their growth. That's not how Pharaoh understood their plans. Pharaoh was very paranoid of them. And so this led to what we're going to read about, the measures that he took in this chapter. And we're going to see in particular in the next chapter, in chapter 2 next time. Well, when we think about this world, everything in it is designed to make us homesick for another place. Do you remember the first time you went away from home? Maybe you went on a trip. Maybe you went away to school. Maybe you went away to the military. And at first it was kind of enjoyable, except if your first time away was the military. It was kind of enjoyable, right? You see new sights, you meet new people, you see new things. But then all of a sudden, as time goes on, you begin to miss the things at home. You miss the things that you're used to. You miss the family traditions that you had, the things that you took part in. You miss mom's cooking. You miss all of those things. And sometimes when you're away, and maybe it's a holiday, and you maybe call your family and you can hear everyone's together, they're having a good time. But wherever you are, you haven't established those kinds of roots and you start to feel homesick. It's just a natural thing that we I'll go through. Maybe you find yourself checking the weather. You say, wow, it's way better at home now than it is where I'm at. And you find yourself doing those things over time when you're away. Well, everything in this world is designed to make us homesick for somewhere else. So here the children of Israel at first, when they started in Egypt, they were just living it up. It was great. But everything changed very quickly. In fact, Pharaoh came up with two diabolical plans to wipe out God's people. We'll refer to them as Plan A and Plan B. Plan A was to work them to death. Work them to death. The first thing he wanted to do to slow the population growth of Israel was to enslave them. It tells us in verse 11, therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. Perhaps he wanted them to die at the hand of the taskmasters. Perhaps what his goal was that was to make their lives so miserable that they wouldn't want to bring any children into it. But he set about to do this. In fact, it says twice in verses 13 and 14 that he worked them ruthlessly. It says that he made their lives bitter in verse 14 with hard service. That word bitter it was taken later as a reference to the Passover dinner where they would have bitter herbs as part of the dinner. And it would make them remember how terrible their days of slavery was. We might remember that they were people who were shepherds. They were shepherding people, but it tells us that they made them work with mortar and brick. They had to build fortified cities like Pithom and Ramses. Ramses became a city of kings. And they had to build it. Sometimes it's hard for us to appreciate the plight of others. We think about our own life. We think about the things that we go through. We think about our day-to-day problems and issues. And we just have no comprehension or understanding of what other people go through. But there's a papyri that's been found that describes what peasants and slaves would have gone through in Egypt at the time. And the Egyptians were incredible taskmasters. They were incredibly cruel. There's a story about a man who was responsible for farming this particular field and growing a certain set of crops. And you probably experienced it in your life where everything went wrong. His animals got away. He would go chase his animals for 3 days in one direction. And then he came back and then he found other things gone. And then he went and everything was destroyed. And he was just trying to eke out a meager existence in this field because he had a slave master over him and he had to produce for the slave master. And the guy's just going nuts trying to find a way to grow some crops. So this is what the papyri says. It goes on this way. It describes his plight. When he reaches his field, this is after he's come back. He's lost his animals. He's just beside himself. When he reaches his field, he finds it broken up. He spends time cultivating and the snake is after him. It finishes off the seed as it is cast on the ground. Imagine that. Now he's got vermin eating the seed as he's throwing it down. Everything for this guy is going wrong. And he is working feverishly to try to bring forth a crop. He does not see a green blade. He does three plowings with borrowed grain. His wife has gone down to the merchants and found nothing for barter. Now the scribe, and the scribe is a taskmaster. The scribe is his, it must be a slave master. Now the scribe lands on the shore, probably coming up the Nile River. He surveys the harvest. Attendants are behind him with staffs, Nubians with clubs. One says to him, give grain. His answer, there is none. As we know, he's done everything he can. The papyrus goes on, says he is beaten savagely. He's bound. He's thrown into the well, submerged, head down. His wife is bound in his presence. His children are in fetters. Do you get a picture of what it was like for the Israelites when they were in bondage in Egypt? This document is found from the same rough period. that Israel was enslaved in Egypt. This is what they were going through in this time of bondage. They had gone from Egypt being like a promised land to Egypt being a place of abject terror and trial and suffering. However, as we notice the story, whatever Pharaoh tried, it backfired. Israel continued to prosper. And we can't put it any better than Moses puts it in verse 12. He writes, and this is God's arithmetic. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and the more they spread abroad. Well, why did they spread? Well, it was divine and supernatural intervention. This is the fulfillment of the covenant promise that God made to Abraham, that they would multiply, that they would grow. And nothing that Pharaoh tried could prevent that from happening. It should be encouraging to us to know that man's curses can do nothing to upend God's blessing. Man's curses can do nothing to upend God's blessing. In no way did this whole situation make the Egyptians feel any better. In fact, it tells us that a sense of dread came over them when they considered the people of Israel in their midst. In fact, this word dread is used in Isaiah 7:16 of the people of Israel, the feeling Israelites had for potentially invading kings. There was a sense of morbidity that came over them when they saw Israel, even though they had the Israelites in chains. Reminds me of a statement that Tertullian made. He was an early church lawyer, a defender of Christians, and he wrote to the Romans. He said in this letter, saying, "Why are you killing us?" He said, "The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Every time you make a martyr, the blood goes into the ground. It's like a seed, and more Christians sprout up. The more you kill us, the more we grow." And that's exactly what was that Pharaoh discovered here. And so then he moves to plan B. He moves to plan B, and that is to commit outright genocide. So Pharaoh's evil grew more extreme as he had plenty of time to figure out the plan A wasn't working. So he called Shipra, which means beautiful, and Pua, which means splendid. And he called them in. These women were literally, it's phrased, midwives of the Hebrews. Which means we don't know if they were actually Hebrew midwives or not, for sure. And believe it or not, there's been at least a 2,000 years of debate over this. Were they Egyptian? Were they Hebrew? More than likely, they were Hebrew because of their names, our Hebrew names. And they're not necessarily symbolic names of anything in the context. So if you're going to lean in one way or the other, it's probably that they were Hebrew slaves, Hebrew midwives. And so he had a plan that he wanted them to carry out. And likely what he wanted them to do is he wanted Hebrews to kill Hebrews. So it says in verse 16, "When you serve as a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live." So now Pharaoh's gone from passive genocide to active genocide. Now, when we think about the history of mankind, there's no shortage of examples of genocide being committed. Even in the 20th century, we have so many examples. Think about the Armenians in Turkey, where over a million Armenian Christians were killed by the Turks during World War I. It's a fact that Turkey still won't acknowledge to this day, but over a million. I heard recently 1.6 million. Then we think about what Adolf Hitler did, right? Adolf Hitler killed over 6 million Jews. He killed innumerable number of gypsies and others with various disabilities. You see this bloodlust over and over again. And we have, sadly, vestiges of this in our own country. We think about Margaret Sanger. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Margaret Sanger, but she is the founder of Planned Parenthood. And Margaret Sanger was a eugenist who wanted to eliminate the black population. In fact, she made a speech before the Ku Klux Klan, the Women's Auxiliary of the Ku Klux Klan, in 1927. And then she wrote a letter to Dr. Clarence Gamble. And this is what she wrote in the letter. "We do not want the word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population. And the minister is the man who can straighten out that idea if it ever occurs to any of their more rebellious members." This is an actual quote by Margaret Sanger. What does this mean by "the minister is the man"? Well, the pastor was a trusted person in the black community. And so what they did was they put pastors on the payroll in the black communities to sell Planned Parenthood to the community so that people would buy into it. But you see, once again, what her ambitions were. It's only been in the last 2 years that Planned Parenthood has even acknowledged any of this. They have been resisting this, fighting this, saying, explaining it away. But now in the last 2 years, they've said, we're not going to be her defender anymore. Even today, Planned Parenthood, you can see it, even if it isn't as overt as it was in Margaret Sanger's day, it's still in the DNA. 80% of all abortion clinics are in black or Latino communities. 80%. All Planned Parenthood abortion clinics are in black and Latino communities, and the vast preponderance of those clinics are in black communities. We see right from the outset that was an ambition of someone like Margaret Sanger. And so we see these kinds of murderous desires in people's hearts, and it's hard to imagine, hard to understand why these things would be entertained, but it's certainly something that Pharaoh entertained. It's certainly something that went through the minds of those who killed the Armenians and killed the Jews in Germany and so on and so forth, and even the unborn in our country. Well, Pharaoh is one in a long line of serpents. The story of the back and forth between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent runs through the scriptures. If you remember the story when David is fighting Goliath, Goliath is described as like a serpentine figure. Remember, he has scales. He has armor with scales and all kinds of things. And it's just, if you read it closely, you'll see that it's depicting Goliath, this kind of a serpent who wishes to kill the seed of the woman. You have this one who will be a forerunner of the Messiah, and Satan is trying to take him out. Or we see in the life of Jesus when Herod, who's another kind of serpent figure, he tries to wipe out all the baby boys of Bethlehem. Why? Because he wants to kill the seed of the woman. But he escapes. We think about the religious leaders in Jesus' own day when Jesus calls them a brood of vipers. What is Jesus referring to? Well, he's saying they're just like their father, the devil. He's going back to the garden. We always have to go back to the garden if we're going to understand the Bible and our place in the story of the Bible. And this is what happens over and over again. And Pharaoh is this kind of serpentine person, the serpentine being who wants to wipe out the seed of the woman right where the seed is most vulnerable, and that is right after the baby's born. But we notice something happen. Again, God thwarted the serpent's plan. Verse 17, "But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live." It's interesting in the story that Pharaoh's name is never mentioned. The elders of Israel's names are never mentioned. And that's all by design. Because the real heroes of the story are these two women. God honored them. And why? Why did they do what they did? Why did they have the courage that they had? It's because they feared God. Because they feared God. And you know, the more we fear God, the less we will fear everything else. All the other fears of our life will melt away when we look to Him as supreme, as we recognize the place that He has in our life. That is when the other fears of our life begin to dissipate, all the other contingencies. Just trust him. Just follow him. Just do what he says. And we'll be okay. That's what God calls us to do. It's interesting. We read, we have one young man in the church who, when he was a little boy, when he was 5, 6 years old, he would come up to me almost every Sunday after church and he would write on a piece of paper this verse or a variation of this verse. It was his favorite verse. It's Proverbs 9:10. It says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight." You see, Pharaoh thought that he was going to deal with them wisely. He thought he was going to deal with them shrewdly. But real wisdom comes from God. And these women had real wisdom because they feared God. And because of that, they did the right thing in that situation. Even though Pharaoh was a scary guy based on the papyri that we read from before. So Pharaoh was obviously miffed. He said, "Why have you done this?" And by the way, it's kind of a funny question because they didn't do anything. That's precisely the opposite. They didn't do anything. And that's why he's mad, not because they did something. "Why have you done this and let the children live?" Now, more than likely, a long period of time passed between when he gave this order to them and when he realized it, because when little Hebrew babies were born, they would have been dressed alike, whether they boys or girls. They would have looked alike. They would have dressed alike. Their hair would have been similar. And so it would have taken quite a few years before the Egyptians would have realized that, there are actually a whole crop of new little boys coming up from Israel. So these ladies had quite a bit of time to think about their answer, and their answer is kind of humorous. And they basically said, "Well, you know, Hebrew moms are just super vigorous. They give birth before the midwives arrive." Now, I can imagine there's probably a few ladies who'd like some of that vigor, right? 24 hours of labor doesn't sound very good. If the women weren't lying, there are two possible scenarios. And by the way, it's kind of interesting. I read one document. One ancient Egyptian document which said that the Egyptians, believe it or not, I kid you not, the Egyptians prided themselves on their women's vigor, how they could give birth more quickly than other women from other people groups. Seriously. So this could have been a slam, kind of saying, you might think that you're really vigorous, but those Hebrews, they're super vigorous. Those Hebrew ladies. So If they were telling the truth, there's two possible scenarios. Number one, God gave them the amazing powers of vigor during that period of time, and the babies were just born really fast before the midwives could come. And these two women were kind of superintendents of all the other midwives that would have been out there. Or the second one was that they put it out there that they wanted to be called late in the delivery process. So that basically the babies were born before they got there so that they could honestly say that they obeyed Pharaoh without really obeying him. Now, we don't really know the answers to these questions, but the truth of the matter is that what these women did was they obeyed God rather than men. And as a result of it, they experienced the blessing of God so that both the midwives and the people of Israel experienced multiplication. They had families. God gave them families, and he also fulfilled his promises to Abraham as the nation continued to multiply, and the desires of the serpent is continually frustrated. Just want to mention three applications of these verses as we've considered them. Number one, even in the silent years, God is always at work. Even in the silent years, and those are the silent years of our lives, God is at work. Israel had been in bondage for all this time. 400 years they had been down in Egypt. Yet the whole time God was multiplying them. It probably didn't feel like God's blessing was on them, but it was. Many probably thought that he forgot them. But he was active in their lives. And oftentimes we forget that God is active in our lives and we just need the eyes to see it. I'm reminded of a story of a young boy who was in a tribal group living on the edge of a jungle. And when he reached a certain age, he had to go and survive on his own in the jungle all night. So he bid his family adieu. He took with him his spear. He went into the jungle and he was terrified, particularly terrified as the sun began to set and then began to go down. And he found himself in the middle of the jungle, engulfed in total darkness. He could hear large animals around him. He could hear things, and all night he could not sleep. And then as the dawn began to come, he began to see a little bit. He noticed in the distance that there appeared to be a creature out there that he couldn't make out, and he was terrified of what that creature could be. And then as the sun began to shine more, he then could make out what that creature was. And the creature was his father, who had been with him the whole night, who'd never left him alone. Even though he felt like he was alone, he never was. His father was there in the event that anything might happen to him. And the same is true for us. Sometimes we feel like we're going through times of our life where we're spinning our wheels. We feel like we're going through times in our life where it seems as if the heavens are like brass. Sometimes it feels like God isn't there at all in our life. But this text shows us that God was fulfilling his promises to the nation, even in those days when it felt as if God wasn't there at all. That's the first thing. The second thing we notice from this is that a few faithful people can make a massive difference. A few faithful people can make a massive difference. See, when we fear God, like those two midwives, he will give us the courage to do what is right, even if we live in a world that is hostile to those things that we believe. One of the amazing things about the story is, and it doesn't always happen this way, but these women lived to see another day. These women lived under God's blessing, and these women are heroes. Think about that. Over 3,000 years ago, the events that are depicted here happened, and they're still remembered. They're still heroes. And a couple of weeks ago, a little girl was born into our congregation, and one of them was named after the first of these two midwives that are mentioned here. People are still naming their daughters after these women. And what made these women so brave was not just their pure courage, but the wisdom that they had in fearing God. And when we fear God, or the more we fear God, the less we will fear everything else. Number three, God uses our troubles to keep us close to himself. God uses our troubles to keep us close to himself. Remember, when the family went down to Egypt, they were comfortable. They were prosperous. Everything was going great. But as long as that was the case, they were never going back to the promised land. God used these events. He used their affliction in a good way to get them moving to where they needed to go, to get them moving toward the promised land. In fact, Charles Spurgeon, he puts it this way. He says, in order to cut loose the bonds that bound them to Egypt, the sharp knife of affliction must be used. And Pharaoh thought he knew it not, though he knew it not, was God's instrument in weaning them from the Egyptian world and helping them as his church to take up their separate place in the wilderness and receive the portion which God has appointed for them. You see, God used their affliction to draw them to another place, another time, to draw them to the promised land. And in the same way, God uses our affliction to do the same thing in our life. You know, all the things that we pursue, the things that we go after, we go with all of our heart and finally we get it. Maybe it's a certain career. Maybe it's a certain object. Maybe it's a certain relationship. And we get the thing we search after and we long for. And then once we get it, what do we always discover? It never turns out to be what we thought it was going to be. It always leaves us empty. And everything in this world will always leave us empty. But that is all by design, because all of these things make us think about another world, another place that God has for us. It's the true promised land. Just like Israel was there in Egypt and they were wandering around and it probably felt as if he wasn't there, but he was actually using their circumstances to draw them where he wanted them to be. So God does the same thing in our life. It's precisely in those times when we feel like we're all alone, in those times where we're afflicted, that often God is doing his greatest work in us, calling us to himself, calling us to the true promised land, which is in Jesus. The true promised land that we long for and search for is in Christ. He gives us food that when we eat, we will never hunger. Water when we drink, that we will never thirst. This is what Jesus offers us. This is what we find in him. And this is something the world could never give us. Do you know this Jesus? Do you know the Savior? The promised land is found in him. Let's pray.